You were starting to tell us how it was that you were at the school before you were listed as a student, but then you said you actually, that you were working for the Department of Mental Health on a project?
Yes.
But you could still get
it was called New Health Roles Project.
New Health Roles Project, okay.
It was something that was started by Rolf Linton and was funded by, I think it might have been funded by OEO, I'm not sure.
So you worked with Rolf Linton then?
Yes.
Did you also know David Keel?
Yes.
I have a call.
He wasn't on the project, but I knew David as a fellow student.
Ah. So tell us a little. So you got to the. How did you get hired onto this project?
Rolf Linton knew a consultant that had been working at Polaroid, and the consultant, the name was Billy Alban, let Rolf know that she thought that I would be a good candidate for the executive director of this New Health Roles project. So I came down, interviewed, and got the job.
Uh-huh. And this was in what year?
I have no idea.
Would it be a good guess that it was before the Minority Student Caucus had been formed?
Oh, yes.
And did you know John Hatch then also?
I knew John Hatch when I moved to North Carolina because he was my neighbor.
Oh, right. Yes, that's right. You lived around the corner from him.
Yes.
And so you were working on this project and the dean told you that you could get a degree also by auditing classes?
Yes, that was a condition of my coming to North Carolina. Was to work on my master's. I had been working on a bachelor's degree at a number of colleges, and this was one way for me to just consolidate and get a master's.
So you didn't have your bachelor's yet?
No, I didn't.
But you were able to start working on a master's?
The agreement was that I would audit all of the courses, take the exams, write the papers, do all the work. And Dean Mays agreed to that. But that was not in writing, and a couple of the professors weren't aware of the arrangement, so that was problematic as well. And then when Bernie Greenberg became the dean, that was even worse because I took biostatistics and he wouldn't agree to that even.
Oh my goodness.
And I passed it.
How did you overcome that? Because you received your master's in 1974, correct?
I guess I don't really know.
Uh-huh.
But not in mental health, right? In health administration?
Health administration.
Interesting. My goodness. So, I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't say it on the recording. I have a little story I can tell you, but I'll tell you some other time.
Okay.
So you were a student in fact, if not in name, because you'd never gone through the admissions process and been formally registered.
Well, I don't know how Dean Mays worked that out. All I told him what my terms were, and that I would come to North Carolina, I would run the program, saw that admissions process, and become a master's. I did get a bachelor's after the fact from Goddard College in Vermont.
Oh.
Goddard had a program that gave you credit for your professional, your work experience.
What an incredible story. Where
it's
is Goddard?
Could
you remind me where Goddard is? Which town?
Plainfield, Vermont.
Plainview?
Plainfield.
Plainfield. Okay. I should know. But did you go to the picnics at John Hatch's house?
Yes.
And you were part of the discussions that led to the formation of the caucus?
Yes.
But your name didn't get on that statement of concerns memorandum.
Well, given my immediate history, that's not surprising, because a lot of things I just didn't do normally.
It may have been because, I don't know, it could have been you couldn't make it at that time, but your name is on a lot of the documents, and you helped formulate the questions and concerns that we took to Dean Mays. And I think he was very much, he in fact had included some of the minutes. I'm pretty sure there were minutes in one of the documents that Dean Mays sent out to perhaps it was other faculty. I think, Vic, you may recall it was a statement of concerns, and it also referenced minutes from, I believe, May 23rd. And those were minutes taken by Walter.
May 23rd? I'm not sure.
That might, we could look that up. I know June 26th were the minutes. And you were the former secretary, Walter, as I can tell from that group.
Walter, is it possible that you didn't want to be on the memorandum about the concerns of black students?
That wouldn't have been a factor.
Okay.
It could have just been you didn't make that meeting, perhaps. You were working, and the rest of us, well, some of us may have been working part time, but sounds like you pretty much had. It's not part full time, a substantial part time job, because I do remember you were working on a mental health project when we were there.
Right.
Do you remember how you felt about us forming that when we had that first meeting at John's? What your thoughts were about it?
Well, I read the piece that Vic sent me of the concerns, and I agreed wholeheartedly with the concerns. Mm-hmm. Except at the time, and I'm thinking in retrospect, that a public health problem was the death rate of young males, black males, the homicide rate. That was later, after the caucus. That was later decided that there was a public health problem.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't talk about that at the meeting.
Yeah, because I believe a large part of the focus was to find someone to assist in recruiting African American students.
Right.
I know we would always hear that it was recognized openly that there weren't very many African-American students, the percentage was so small, and we would hear that it was difficult to find African-American students, to recruit African-American students. So I think part of our solution, as the group saw it, was perhaps we needed a position that actually may have been Dean May's decision, but we knew there needed to be assistance in recruiting students. And he asked, in some fashion or form, I don't remember exactly, who would like, if he employed a person whose focus, part of their job responsibility, was to recruit additional African American students. Does that sound familiar?
I think that was a major focus, and then coming up with the data was backup.
Right.
Was to solidify the need.
Mm-hmm. I think before we present the written statement that was presented, included the fact that looked at health disparities. I don't remember the specific data, but we clearly said that there were so many disparities, and the School of Public Health could play such a central role in recruiting other African Americans into the field.
Yeah.
Speaking of statistics, Walter, seems like I recall some of the students, some of us would speak about after attending the biostatistics and epidemiology courses, because all of us had to take the initial, maybe the 100 or 101, whatever that initial introductory course was.
Yes.
And there were so many statistics that pointed out these disparities. Maybe that was one reason that drove us to that. But that several people said they really didn't. It left you feeling, I guess, just feeling the need and a somewhat somber, and if I could use the word sad or disheartened, just to look at how severe the problem was. I mean, we all had some idea from our prior background, but did that have any reflection or any impact, I guess is a better word, on you as all of this was brought to our attention?
I don't think the statistics sort of solidified what I knew to be true from working in the communities around Boston. And that it wasn't an aha moment.
Mm-hmm. Right, because we already knew it was a problem.
Yes.
Right. It was what can we do about the problem rather than just hear about it.
Yes.
One of the things I've been wondering about is the extent to which the school was moving into diversity and inclusion before the caucus was formed. Based on the documents I've been looking at from the archives, it seems that there was quite a bit of movement in the university and in the school, and some of the school faculty were involved in the university-level activities as well, activities to bring minorities, particularly African Americans, into the university and into the School of Public Health. And that when the caucus was formed, that accelerated it, but it wasn't what stimulated it originally. Is that your impression or understanding?
My impression that the outreach for minorities to the School of Public Health wasn't until after we formed the caucus. The rationale was prior to that, in terms of recruiting minorities, was more athletic oriented. They wanted athletes.
Well, the university may have wanted athletes, but the school was writing things about the need for minority health professionals in public health to go out and help communities that were having health problems.
Well, I didn't see that happen until after the minority caucus had raised the issues with Dean Mace.
Interesting.
Well, all I had to do was look at the number of minority faculty prior to that.
The faculty were very low. I mean, there weren't any. But there were the number of students did increase during the 1960s.
Well, the number of minority students came from another country.
Many were from abroad, but the number
that's
of,
right.
But the number of domestic also increased. So that's something I need to do is try to get those data on the number of minority students who were U.S. origin.
Yeah, that didn't happen until we raised the issue. And Bill Small was brought on board.
Because I think we looked back, I can't say we looked back that far, but I don't remember it being a point of discussion at all until that picnic. And that was the summer after the fall. Was it the spring? The spring, the meeting with Dean Mace was May, and we came on board around August or September, and I don't think the picnic was until that following spring. I'm not sure. Do you remember from that data? It seems like, Vic, we worked on trying to come up with that date one time.
When the picnic seemed to take place starting in December of 70 and going into the spring of 71.
Okay, so and it was outside, so we didn't, I think the picnic then was the spring of 71. I don't think, I remember there was a lot of, we were detached pretty much from each other, you know, except friendly social conversation, but there was no planned activity or any real discussions as a group before that picnic.
I agree.
So I'm looking at a memorandum from January 15th, 1969 from Dean Mays, to Dean Mays from Rolf Linton, who was then heading something called the Minority Committee or minority committees. And he said, "We see as the next step the appointment by you of two task groups. Task group A is for building up the Negro presence in the school, and task group B is for launching new programs for special groups." And
what month was that again?
That was January 15th, 1969.
Okay, and we met in May.
No, 69.
Oh, 69, right. But that would be, I wonder, were you there in 69, Walter? Or was John there? I don't remember hearing any, I know that memo you were mentioning, but in terms of it being any part of discussion to involve the students that were there, I think the student part was initiated by the caucus, and I don't remember Dean Mays referencing any of that. And maybe they had been talking with some of the chairs of, like, when I went to Central, I don't know whether that was influenced to try to recruit students from there, but I don't remember any actual agenda item that came before us prior to that picnic.
So,
in terms of student involvement.
So,
yeah, I think the only thing I would say is that Rolf Linton would know if there was any conversation about increasing a minority or American minority students. Because we had a couple of Indians. Native American Indians. I think one was in health education.
Okay, it was after I left. I think I remember.
Bobby Blayboy was his name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at a memorandum from January 20th, 1969, from Dorothea Layton, whom I guess you would know, Walter, from Mental Health?
Yes.
And Marion Highrider in Public Health Nursing. And it's addressed,
yeah.
It's addressed to
Marion's
Highrider.
I think it was High something, but I don't think it was Highrider.
Well,
she also had an appointment with the public health nurses.
And the memo's addressed to the student council of the School of Public Health. And it says, as you probably know, the Black Student Movement, which I think is the campus one, the BSM, the Black Student Movement has made a series of demands regarding their opportunities, etc., at UNC. And the faculty committee, which was formed as a result of the Dixon resolution to the faculty in the faculty council, has prepared a report which recommends many of the changes which the BSM demands.
Okay. I can remember going to one meeting. Go ahead.
Now, I was going to say, I think that was a very strong campus movement, I think, about that time. And, you know, the School of Public Health was always pretty much detached from what was going on the main campus. And I'm thinking about, I remember some of the movement just because I remember some people, like from one person from Durham that was very active, probably around that time. And even to now, they have a program called Pioneers, which is African American group of early African American students at UNC. And there may be some involvement from people at school who are graduates from School of Public Health, but I think not a lot, because that wasn't that connection, and it may have been because a lot of students in School of Public Health were older and some were working, and we were pretty much removed into all our courses being right there in that building. I took a couple of courses in city and regional planning.
Yes.
But that's interesting, Dick. That would be interesting to look at that.
Well, and there were some faculty from the school who are active at the university level in this area, including in the faculty council.
Right. And so they may have brought information back and shared it at School of Public Health.
But apparently not, from what you're saying, apparently not with the Black students at the school.
No, I definitely don't, but I wasn't there in the 60s, but from the time I got there, I don't remember that.
I think there's a historical fact that we might be forgetting, is that a number of faculty had worked in an African project.
Let me look at my notes. They're not my notes. They're. Let me see.
Okay.
I think right. Guy Stewart was. I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He had. And I know Rolf Linton did.
And Harry Phillips did it.
Harry
Phillips, he was in that South African group, and John Castle,
yes, and so I think there might have been some latent support from the faculty, from those members who had international experience.
And I think that's how John Hatch had John to share this with us, but it seems like Guy Stewart knew about John from his work in Mississippi with the federally qualified health center and was instrumental in him coming to the School of Public Health. And Harry Phillips was my advisor from health planning. Of course, Guy Stewart was my advisor. He was the dean for health education for my department. And they were both part of that African, South African movement.
Who was the chancellor?
Ooh, I don't remember.
I'm looking at through Vic's notes.
Yeah.
Might be Carlisle Citizen.
But I believe the chancellor for public health or whatever, I guess, they had a strained organizational structure with deans and chancellor, but there was someone above Castle that had an experience with the folks who had worked in Africa.
Are you thinking of Cecil Sheps, maybe, who was the vice chancellor for health affairs?
Who was that?
Cecil Sheps was vice chancellor.
Cecil Sheps. They called him Cecil then.
Well, there was Cecil Sloan. There was Cecil Sloan, who was a faculty member in epidemiology, also from South Africa.
Oh, that's it. Speaking of Sheps, and it seems like that was where Don actually was brought on board at the Sheps Center before. He had a relationship with the School of Public Health again. He could tell the accurate story.
I think
John
point on the influence of the faculty from South Africa on this inclusive mission.
I think so.
I don't remember. I don't know if you all remember from the minutes. How many of those faculty that were included on some of the minutes? I know some people were copied. I know Harry Phillips, as I recall, was listed as a coordinator for something like minority affairs. One of the notes.
Oh, I don't remember that.
You don't?
Oh, I was just looking at some of Vic's notes before.
Yeah, it's a set of notes I had, some of Vic's notes again. Vic, all these notes.
The danger when you list one person's name, you're going to exclude some other person.
Yeah, this is Lois Eisler. Do you all remember her? Oh.
Only because you mentioned her before.
Hold on 1 second.
You know, I've read through all these documents before, but I never remember what's in them. And there are quite a few. But I think there was a fairly large effort going on in 1968 and 69 to bring more African-American students to the school. And evidently that was being done by faculty without really involving minority students, as best I can tell.
Right.
Until the Minority Student Caucus got involved, became, and then you all were heavily involved. And became a real force in the school.
Yeah, I wasn't. I didn't come to the school because of the need or acknowledgement of need for minorities to join the school. If I had been, it was because of Rolf Linton's personal commitment, but I don't think I was ever part of a larger
I think that several
I don't know if they ever considered me. They would probably consider me Jewish before they would consider that I had any African American history, ancestors.
That's very interesting. You know, I think a number of the faculty were actually actively recruiting African Americans the way Ralph brought you in, not because you were African Americans necessarily, but I know that Sherman James was recruited because of a former, I mean, a fellow he grew up with, who Cecil Sloan said he was, I think it was Cecil Sloan, who, or Ralph Patrick, I'm blocking on who it was, had him as a student and then said, you know, I'm looking for African-American faculty and got a referral that way.
So there might have been some of that informal recruitment by faculty occurring before the caucus. But I just know that the presence of the caucus and the meeting with Dean Mays was instrumental in having things move far faster than before.
And were you in that meeting with Dean Mays?
No. I don't think so. I don't remember it. The only time I met with him was with just one-on-one or with Ralph Linton.
Uh-huh. I gather that Ralph is still alive, by the way.
He is still alive. I spoke, well, let's assume he is. I spoke to him several months ago. And I was really unhappy to hear that his wife had died because our two families were reasonably close. I believe he's still alive.
Do you think he will recall any of this history?
Probably, because he was a great note taker.
He certainly has written a bunch of very useful memoranda.
Yeah. Because I was thinking about what Vic had said, and that would be interesting whether the two things in some ways collided, though they may have been on different tracks trying to get toward some of the same goals.
So...
The last I heard, I can't think of the... He lives in a town that is close to Carrboro.
Mm-hmm.
Between Carrboro and the next town where Paul Alston lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I
can't think of it.
Chatham County somewhere.
In Chatham County somewhere. That's right.
I think I can actually connect with him because David Keel, I have to return a phone call from David Keel.
Yeah.
But David told me that he recently wrote a chapter with Ralph.
Right. Well, David would know.
Well, I will get in touch with David as soon as I get a chance to. But why don't we go back to the so the caucus was formed. They met with Dean Mays. And then you became the secretary at some point.
Yes, I don't know how that happened, to tell you the truth.
And you probably became the secretary before we met with Dean Mays, because we had meetings prior to then to decide what we wanted to look at the agenda, and Dean Mays was an outcome of having some prior meetings. The Dean Mays meeting was.
Okay.
You don't know how you became the secretary.
No.
You were secretary on June 26th. You were secretary.
So it was maybe one of those things somebody needed to do it. And
yeah.
Maybe it was because you missed the meeting with the dean that they made you, that was when they volunteered you to be secretary.
Yeah, I just have a sign on the computer that says meeting disconnected.
But on June 26th, you sent out some minutes listing yourself as the secretary.
Oh, okay.
So, at least we have...
I have to trust your word.
Well, maybe Walter made the difference in formal minutes, because I'm looking at just the random group I have in front. I know we had meetings and planned because we sent a memo to Daniel Mays prior to the meeting on what we wanted to discuss. So maybe someone took notes, but I see all of Walter's minutes seem to be maybe after the answer.
I don't know.
Do you hear an echo?
Pardon?
I hear an echo on my phone.
Well, there's no one else in the room.
No, it's not the
phone.
Okay, it could have been the phone call I received. I was going to try to connect her, but it wasn't a good time for Lois Isler that I've been trying to reach that. I thought that would have been really fun to get her on the recording, but she's supportive but couldn't do it right then. Okay.
So after the caucus was formed and the meetings were going on and you were the secretary and so on, where you were in your, I mean, that was fairly early in your program at the school, because it was 1971, the winter, fall of 71 going into 72. Do you remember anything about what happened after that in the sequence with the caucus and other things at the school?
Only that we had interviewed some candidates and we chose Bill Small.
And he came in November?
I guess.
He came to a meeting in October, but then he officially started in November.
Okay.
And after that, in the winter, there was some memoranda from the caucus. I guess by then, Bernie Greenberg had become dean. And the tone of the memoranda became a little bit more... less happy.
That might have been the impact of my relationship with him. Maybe it leaked out in the minutes.
Maybe. I don't know. It was a complaint about the curriculum, I think, and about non-responsiveness from the dean's office. And I don't know that you had written the memorandum. Well, I don't think you signed the memorandum in question. Excuse me a second.
Wasn't a fan of him, of his.
That's unfortunate, but... Oh, did you know Jim Morrell also?
The name is somewhat familiar, but I can't say I do.
Because Jim was a... he worked for the Department of Epidemiology. He was the first black professional employee in the Department of Epidemiology. And then he entered the bios department working on a degree. Oh, but you weren't in bios. But
no, but I don't remember him particularly.
Okay. Let's see. I'm looking through all these different documents trying to sort. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to prepare these into chronological order, which would have been really...
Oh, no problem, because the way our Zoom hookup has worked out, you know, that's another part of the difficulty of communicating.
So, in February 1972, there was this memo from the minority student group to the minority advisory committee, which I think had Ralph Linton as one of the key people on it, and it's about the concerns of the minority student group. And it says, the events of last semester have brought us to the point wherein it is necessary to determine what our ultimate objective as a group is to be. We have determined that that objective is to facilitate the creation of, quote, qualified, unquote, minority health manpower to meet the health manpower shortage. With this objective clearly fixed in our minds, there are several issues which are priorities in our considerations. And then it sets out, one, the recruitment of minority students, and sets the 25% minority enrollment goal by 1975. And admission criteria and procedure is the second. Intensive recruitment has little or no effect if barriers stand in the way of admission. So, it's talking about ways, I think, to recruit from groups that have not even gotten undergraduate degrees. That there must be a way to bring in, it says, many minority health professionals are forced to remain in jobs where there is little chance of further upward mobility because of their lack of credentials. They have not been able to acquire baccalaureate training nor graduate training, but have gained valuable expertise. What will be required of these health professionals is learning the theory, supporting the processes they have been performing. And then, secondly, there have been occasions wherein applying minority students have become bogged down in the quagmire of the application process. And then there's the question of departmental minority quotas. Then it talks about the essentialness of funding. Then it goes on to retention programs, and then employment and curriculum. So it's a pretty, and then personnel, research, minority affairs office, policy and finance. This is a pretty impressive memorandum. And it doesn't say it's a draft. Oh, it says draft for discussion. So I don't know if it was ever sent.
Yeah. What student names did you see on that?
None. It says the minority.
I don't recall. I was trying to see who might have been involved.
It says it's from the minority student group.
Mm.
And you were graduated by then, right?
Yeah, I would have completed. Then listen, you said 72.
Yeah, this was in. February of 72, beginning of February 72.
Yeah, I think I would have, because I started in 70 to 71, and I think I finished around June 72, after I was there working on my thesis. It was remotely, you know, from home, and I wasn't actively involved.
So this copy I'm looking at has Bill Small's name written on it, handwritten.
Mm-hmm.
I expect this was his copy.
Yes.
So maybe we can ask him about it. Show it to him and ask him about it.
Yeah, he would be a good person to ask about.
And the next memorandum is from November 1972. And it talks about negative racial image projections in curricular presentations.
And that was November 72?
Yeah. 80% of respondents felt that subtle negative implications could be read into statements made by some instructors. Does that ring any bells, Walter?
Well, it doesn't ring any bells historically. But I'm thinking about the conversation lately about entitlement.
and how Caucasian folks made the assumption about African Americans. Well, certainly the law enforcement said they're criminals. You know, definition of a criminal was a black male under 20. And so that just sort of just triggers thoughts of more recent kinds of things. I know that Jane was standing in line at a store, and an older white woman told her to stand 20 feet away from her.
What?
And Jane had been waiting in line at this store to open for over an hour. And the woman yelled at her, "Did you hear what I said? Move away from me. Your people are the ones who..." Yeah.
When did this happen?
Oh, in the last year or so.
You're kidding.
And so Jane said, "Well, I'm not moving. And if you want, you can go to the end of the line and with people you're more comfortable with, and you wait there." With the effect.
Wow.
I was surprised that she said that, because I thought, Jane, I thought maybe she might have hauled off and smacked this woman. But she didn't. But just this morning, a man from the city told Jane was shoveling some snow. And the man from a city truck told her that she shouldn't be putting snow into the street. And that if someone had an accident, they could sue us. And the fact of the matter was, Jane was just cleaning out the end of the driveway where it met the street. And none of it was going into the street. It was going up on a bank and on our property. And so again, the whole issue of entitlement and the need to correct poor, ignorant African Americans and show them the right way to go. So that's what that triggered for me.
Wow.
Those kinds of statements about misrepresenting African-American folks. But if we're viewed with low morals, that we're thieves, crooks, a lot of the arguments that Trump used for people at the border, on the southern border. So that's what it reminded me of, not anything back then. I don't remember anything specific that made me feel uncomfortable.
What I remember is this feeling that there were conversation among students after attending some of the classes like biostatistics and epidemiology. And we looked at, as comparisons were made between the black and white population for certain indices, you know, how blacks would always have more of, you know, more diabetes, more heart disease. I'm trying to think of some of the, at that time, what we call STDs, the sexually transmitted diseases that comes to my mind because I remember as a student prior to School of Public Health, the local health department pointing out certain disease states and said, "These are your people." So,
oh, really?
I remember it being laid out that way at the school by our courses, but whether it just was, you looked and saw this the need there, and it just made, it had a, can't think of the term I want, but the effect was somewhat disappointing, not disappointing, but you didn't feel good about the status of everything. But that did trigger my memory from that early visit to the health department. I was even junior high or elementary school, and we had a trip to the local health department, and the person who was the nurse brought out a board with all these statistics, and that's how she referred to it. These pointed out, these are your people. So, I don't remember that vivid example at the school.
I don't either.
No, I never.
We had enough of it.
No.
In our day-to-day life, but I can't attribute any of that to the school presentation.
And in fact, I thought the exposure we had, the professors like Castle, and, you know, were people that, you know, now when I look at, you know, how fortunate we were to have people with that background and experience. So that's all I can recall of that.
But it's... I just can remember going into a store with some friends and being followed by staff of the store.
Mm. Was that while you were a student?
Pardon?
Was that why you were a student at school with public health?
No, this was prior to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that you were considered... The stereotype was we were going to steal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I do know that when I came, we had a period of time in Alamance County where single women who were having children out of wedlock was being sterilized. Do you remember that?
Yeah, the eugenics. I don't remember Alamance per se, but I remember the North Carolina Eugenics Commission, and that was happening. Was it related to people with certain mental health conditions? And that clearly it was wrong, so I'm not saying because of that, but they targeted people on that. I think John Hatch was he one of the purpose when they started looking at that eugenics group? May have done some work with that, but yes, it was going on several places in North Carolina.
Well, I guess the reason why I say Alamance, because that county board is Virginia. And I can remember when I was moving from Boston to North Carolina, and I left Petersburg. I forget the name of the highway, 74 or whatever, came right down through Alamance County. Uh-huh. And off to the right side of the road, it said, "Welcome to Klan Country."
Oh, yeah. I don't remember that one, but that was one in Johnston County like that.
Okay.
Welcome to Klan Country. And if you were traveling, and we'd always say, make sure you get through Johnston County before nightfall.
Oh, well.
That was a lot of fun.
Those kinds of experiences, it's difficult to forget. And I can just remember, what did I get my family into? Because at the time, I had two children.
Wow. That was quite a welcome to North Carolina.
You can say that again. If I had any sense, I would have taken a picture of it. But I guess my sense was, keep moving, don't stop.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember that makes me think of one of the concerns of the Black Student Conference was how we could help students who are coming in, particularly those from out of the area, to find housing. I think we broke into committees or groups. Maybe a couple of people are going to work on trying to develop a list of where housing options. We want to help people where they were having financial struggles, whether it's employment or helping to seek getting funding from some sources, because that was one of the things on the list of assisting financing for students. But I remember housing was a big thing, and I think one of the last things that the caucus did when I was there, do you remember us planning for a picnic, Walter, for the new incoming students, because that was going to be the new incoming students' formal orientation, but we wanted also to do an orientation for yes. them from the Black Student Caucus.
Yes, I think that was, I knew we thought that was very important.
Mm-hmm.
Because those of us who had been there for a while, like John and myself, it was good to meet other new students. And I can remember some discussion, I can't solidify it, but it was, we were profiling some of the professors to be careful of. And we were sharing that information
mm-hmm.
with the new students.
Yes.
And we knew that epidemiology and biostatistics were going to kick people's butt.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember we profiled some instructors that we were having trouble with, but I don't know who they are. I don't remember.
I think that's maybe, do you remember when Bill Jenkins and Jim Moreno formed the survival course? It wasn't there when I was there, but I remember Vic actually had an interview with Bill Jenkins talked about, and I think Jim Moreno.
Well, I remember reading that in some of Vic's notes
mm-hmm.
about survival strategy.
Uh-huh.
It was called the Survival Committee or the Survival Course, and it was taught for 3 years, and I can't remember if it started in 74 or 75. I think it was 75, 6, and 7, but it might have been the three years, 1 year earlier.
I was fortunate to have a reasonably strong math background. So biostatistics didn't bother me that much, because when I worked at Polaroid, I had to do statistical projections, that part. But what was totally foreign to me was epidemiology. I understood the total concept, but I couldn't put the pieces together for a while.
Yeah.
So I could have benefited.
Yeah. Some people form study groups. I'm trying to think like Sadie and Tegan and I did form a study group together. I don't know. But that was Bill Moreno one of the lab assistants at that time, even though they had not started the formal survival course?
No.
Okay.
I had my own study group because the project that I was running kept me away. So I was in South Carolina and other parts of the state. So a lot of the work that I did, I had to fly. So I needed someone to take notes.
Right.
So I tried to find some of the brightest people to take notes for me. So when I came back home, I had to hit the ground running.
Yeah.
So did you work for that New Roles Project the whole time you were in Chapel Hill?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Did you work for the New Roles Project the whole time you were in Chapel Hill?
Yes, but I also do some private consulting work.
Okay, as well as being a student.
And so, matter of fact, when I went back to Polaroid, I did some consulting work for them. And so I was in and out a lot. I think one time I broke my foot or something, and so I missed class.
Ooh.
So I needed that support system.
Can we go back to your early career a little bit so I can just fill in my mental notes about how you came to the school? Where did you grow up originally?
I'm sorry, what?
Where did you grow up?
Oh, I grew up outside of Boston.
Uh-huh.
In a town, a predominantly African-American community with a heavy dosage of British West Indians. My father, his mother and father came from Antigua.
Your mother and father came from Antigua?
No, my father's mother and father.
Your father's mother and father. Okay, your grandparents.
Yeah. And but, I mean, we had a lot of West Indians in the community that I grew up in.
And what was that community?
West Bedford.
West Bedford.
BDFORD.
And
9 miles northwest of Boston.
Okay. And did you go to, so you went to school there and then stayed in Boston for college originally?
I went into Boston State Teachers College.
Is that in Boston? And that's in Boston?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And how long were you there, and then how did you get from there to Goddard or Goddard?
To taking courses at Harvard. I used to run an analytical lab at Polaroid. So I took chemistry courses at Harvard part-time. And then I became involved in a minority-focused group at Polaroid. I was a secretary there, too.
You were a secretary.
It was called the Volunteer Committee. And we were trying to do the same thing that we were doing at the School of Public Health, trying to get minorities in upper management positions. And one of my responsibilities was to run the corporate it was what we called it, Intercultural Workshop Group. And that's where vice presidents were in these groups along with people who were custodians. And so it was really, and then there was females who were managers and or not managers. So the intercultural workshops were to include all the issues that have been dealt with Biden. And so we had these groups, and we had psychiatrists running these groups. But my job was to organize it corporately and hire the psychiatrists and the trainers. And one of the trainers was a woman named Billy Alban, who was friendly with Rolf Linton. And it was at that point I decided that I didn't want to help make Polaroid run better so it could make more money. But my real interest was in the community, because even though we had a community center that I've since found that was rare in African-American communities, and I was in charge of a teen program. And so we had dances and took trips, and I got tickets to Celtics games and things like that. And then at one time, the country was in an uproar about violence, riots, fires. And so Polaroid joined a community of companies that's committed to hiring young black
students for the summer. The idea was to get them off the street and give them some money, let them, you know, work for some money and get a sense of who they were. So there would be less violence, less rioting, less... But most of the violence was not between blacks, but it was between the police and young black people. So they wanted to... That was happening all over the country. That was, so I represented Polaroid in that, and I don't know, we got about 1,000 jobs, something like that, for the summer. So.
But how
did... That work, and really introduced me to, vicariously, to Ralph Linton. And it's because of Billy Allman. There was a man named, she had a partner named Irv Pollitt. And they had contracts with various companies to put on these intercultural workshops. And so my job was to organize it so we could go away and have a place to have these workshops. And you provide the staffing for it and the food and all of that stuff. So that's how I ended up coming to the School of Public Health, because of Ralph Linton. Received a recommendation from Irv and Billy.
And how did you get to Polaroid? From a teacher's, a state teacher's college, and then you were hired to do analytical chemistry?
Well, I didn't start in it. I started in the lab, and then they had a system of being able to apply for jobs. And so I applied for this lab technician job in the research division, and that turned into an opportunity to run an analytical lab. And so while I was doing that, I took evening courses. I was also a management student at Northeastern University. So I had a lot of energy back then, and I was wearing several hats.
So how long did you go to Boston State Teachers College before you started doing all these other things?
I think I was doing a lot of some of the other things at the same time.
My goodness.
I did go full-time to Boston State Teachers, but I also played basketball, so we were traveling around on that too.
And working in the lab?
Yeah. Actually, when I was at Boston State Teachers, I worked at Polaroid. But also behind Boston State's Teachers was a hospital, Boston Lion Inn. And so I was a custodian from like 4 to 10. After class got out, just walked over to the hospital. I worked my second job. But I was... Part of that was because I was married. And I had a family. And I didn't come from wealth. So I had to work. And at that time, it was no big deal for me. I also had a Saturday job as a custodian at a bakery, and so I would come home looking like the doughboy snow because of the all the flour and stuff.
Did you say you had a bakery or you worked in a bakery?
Basement where?
was the custodian in the bakery.
Okay.
And cleaning up that, it was a real interesting job. Yes. So I got powder all over me, flour all over me.
Oh, wow.
I think maybe we should try to get a professional interviewer to interview you about your young adult years, your teenage and young adult years, because this is an incredible story.
Well, my father worked two jobs, and so it was natural. Part of the West Indian culture was that you worked two jobs. My father said you always had to have a backup.
But you were working more than two. Yeah.
So one of the things that West Indians did was to buy 2 and 3 family homes and rented them out to many of the relatives that came over. To the States. That was part of the culture. We knew we had to go to college. Nobody emphasized that in our families. We knew we had to do something beyond high school, which is part of the way we lived. I grew up living on the third floor of a 3-family home that was owned by a cousin.
I think it deserves a professional interviewer to interview about that, because it may be typical for West Indians, but it certainly is different from most of the stories that I'm familiar with. And
well, there were Cambridge, Mass, Boston had large West Indian communities. In fact, my grandfather went back to Antigua and brought back his wife, I guess girlfriend, and his mother. And they didn't have planes back then. They had to wait for boats. I think they came over on the Fortunato or something like that. But interesting. I'd really like to spend some time doing some ancestral research, because I have great-great-grandmothers who were slaves on the plantations of Alexander Hamilton's family.
Oh, my goodness.
And an uncle who did some of the research, and then one of his sons picked it up. Yeah, and then I think it was 1841 or 48, it was Jubilee Day, where the British had freed the slaves in the British West Indies. So the slaves were then allowed to get married. And one of my, I don't know which great grandmother, but she married a man named John Isaacs. But she had been she had had offspring, not my grandmother, but my grandmother's mother or grandmother, I'm not sure, was an offspring of a relationship of a union with one of the Hamiltons. I don't know who it was. That part's not clear. So I have slavery in my ancestry. I think my mother's side might have had some, because they came from the coastal part of North Carolina.
Wow, what an incredible family story you've got.
I just wish I could put it all together. I don't have the time, nor the money. Some of my kids have tried it. They didn't get very far.
Excuse me, Fred. I'm going to have to leave the call for another call. But it's fascinating.